Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this somewhat select gathering, very select gathering tonight. It's a very interesting aspect of the program that we put on, and we pride ourselves on covering the world. And there are some areas of the world which are most important, which people really don't seem to have a clear appreciation of, and other parts of the world which are just as important, but people seem to be very, very interested in. One of the parts of the world which we need to know a whole heap more about is Africa, and particularly West Africa. And if you ask around the community about West Africa, you'll find blank looks with most of the people you need to talk to. But tonight, we're going to fix that here, because we're very lucky to have His Excellency Mr. Ian McConnell, the Australian High Commissioner in Nigeria. The flyer says this, and I think it's pretty right. No part of the world seems more mysterious or forbidding than West Africa. Australians think of it as a region of equatorial extremes, of being beset by poverty, disease and conflict. We reflect on the dismal colonial period, including the horrors of slavery, and on our post-independence record. This is nicely put, I think, that appears to be far from successful. But the next bit, I think, is very interesting. Well, it's all very interesting. Yet West Africa, for all its problems, has a rich store of humanity, hope and promise. And I'm looking forward to you to explain that to us, Ian. At the heart of this highly diverse region is Nigeria, a populous giant that is pursuing democracy in the face of many internal tensions, and from whose perspective we will examine the region's progress and focus on where Australia's interests lie. And who better to tell us about that than the representative of Australia in Nigeria, His Excellency Mr. Ian McConville, Australian High Commissioner. Now, High Commissioners, let me tell you, because you all know this, are highly important people. The old definition of a diplomat was somebody who was prepared to lie for his country. But in fact, High Commissioners do much more than that. They,
I thought you said, never lie.
And we're not accusing you of being part of the News of the World. Ian is his non-resident accreditation to a wide range of other West African states, the Gambia, Cameroon, the Republic of Congo, Niger, Gabon, and Benin. He was previously High Commissioner in Mauritius, a most interesting part of the world, Mauritius, with accreditation to Comoros, Madagascar, and the Seychelles. He's also served in Phnom Penh and Islamabad, and of course has held a number of senior positions in Canberra with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, with whom he's been for over 20 years now, I think it is. Ladies and gentlemen, to tell us all about Australia's interests in West Africa, and in particular in Nigeria, would you please welcome His Excellency Mr. Ian McConville.
Thank you, Michael. I'm very pleased to be here. The last time I was here was as a student at Monash University, and I came here in a very clapped-out Holden Kingswood HG, 1970, and Kevin Hogue, who was a very senior and distinguished member of our diplomatic service, was giving a presentation, and his daughter, in fact, was in one of my English tutorials at Monash. So she told me that Kevin was giving a presentation. Anyway, after the presentation, which of course was very interesting and perhaps was one of the reasons why I'm here now, we had a discussion about his daughter, and then I said, "Oh well, I'm out at Monash." She said, "Oh, I need a lift to get out to because I'm staying with my daughter." And I said, "Oh, I'll give you a lift." I didn't tell him which car he was going to go out in, as an ambassador in Manila or Russia or New York, wherever he was at the time. Anyway, it is a pleasure to be here, and I think that it's a part of the world that we in Australia have certain perceptions about, and I think it's good to challenge those perceptions. And so in the course of this presentation, which I understand from Michael, has to finish at 25 past at the latest, we can look and see what our perceptions are and whether they approximate the truth on the ground. Anyway, I thought as a starting point, I might give you a brief overview of the countries that I look after and where indeed they are located, because it can get a bit confusing, West Africa. The one thing I've learnt since being in Abuja and the surrounding countries in the past year is now where all the capitals are, what their names are, and where each country is contiguous to. I should acknowledge right at the outset that I have an esteemed colleague who many of you will know well, Bill Fisher, who is in the audience here. Bill and I are travelling buddies. We have travelled now to 6 countries of West Africa in the Francophone domain. Bill, amongst his various responsibilities, is the Prime Minister's Special Envoy for the Francophonie. And Bill is just sitting right at the back, on cue to laugh at my jokes when someone needs to laugh at my jokes. But anyway, we have had some good times travelling, some interesting times. We know the vagaries and tribulations of internal travel in West Africa, and I think a few of those observations might come out in the course of this presentation. This is a list of the countries that I am accredited to, and in the course of the next 25 minutes, I'll talk about each of those countries in various ways. It's quite interesting. Now I've got a little red thing that goes. That seems to be way out of my parish, but for various reasons, it was determined that I should have 2 Anglophone countries and 5 Francophone countries. And the other mission that we have that looks after the West Africa is in Ghana, which is, of course, there. And between the 2 missions we cover West Africa, I think Billy Williams, who's the High Commissioner in Ghana, can lay claim to one more country than I, which is a source of great disappointment to me. But I think I've worked through the issues about that in the last year, especially having to travel to all these countries. So we start off with Nigeria. Now, don't think this is the last I'll deal with these countries. It's just to give you a brief snapshot of publicly accessible information which gives you a feel of the essentially the statistics, the relevant statistics of each of these countries. Nigeria, of course, is fascinating for its complexity. And you'll see 250 ethnic groups, and the just how that makes the governing of Nigeria, you could appreciate the challenges that this country has in having a consensus about leadership and indeed in forging a way forward. But one of the things that will come through in this presentation is Nigeria is seeking to be a leader in Africa, and it has good claims, and it's much maligned in terms of its reputation internationally, but on the ground, the results speak for themselves, and you'll find, certainly in West Africa, that Nigeria looms extremely large in everyone's reckoning. Niger, I presented credentials in Niger on the 25th of January this year. We established diplomatic relations with Niger for the first time on the 7th of May 2009. So what you have is all of a sudden we have not just diplomatic relations, but we have a moving forward relationship with a country that we knew very little about before as a government. We have mining interests. There's 5 mining companies active in Niger, and it has some very interesting security issues, which I'll deal with as a separate issue, because essentially you have Al-Qaeda, Islamic Maghreb, operating in an area that is around the badlands of East Mali, and every now and then they come in and they take some hostages, and sometimes those hostages get killed, and they're predominantly French. Bill and I did some jogging in Niamey, and we didn't get mugged or caught by the Akim, as we call them, so it's not all a bad story. And it's actually a very interesting country, who are very receptive to the arrival of Australian interest and engagement. Benin is a neighbouring country of Nigeria. The second biggest port of Nigeria is Cotonou, which is here. And what that means is there's a lot of smuggling that goes on. And I was at the border near Porto Novo around 3 weeks ago, and it was the busiest border I've ever seen. There was just constant traffic going in all directions. And of course, on the Nigerian side, there were about 9 unofficial police, groupings that were along the road at strategic points, all unofficially claiming various payments for the transfer of goods from Cotonou across to Lagos. So there's a lot of business that takes place, and not all of it official. Cameroon is essentially on the east coast, or the east frontier with Nigeria, a very interesting country with quite a prospective minerals environment. And one of the things that we'll briefly touch on is there's quite an extraordinary geological symmetry between Brazil and West Africa. And if you think of the second biggest mining company in the world, which unfortunately isn't Australian, it is indeed made its money from iron ore in Brazil. And you'll find that Brazil fits very neatly into the Gulf here, and you'll see that there's very prospective iron ore in all this area, which the miners have worked out quite some time ago. And that's a very interesting story that we'll be looking at. Gabon, headed by the famously named Ali Bongo, who is the son of Omar Bongo, who Bill and I met around about 2 months ago. This is an interesting country, a small country in terms of population, and one of the wealthiest in sub-Saharan Africa, interestingly, after Botswana and of course South Africa, and then Mauritius, if we call that sub-Saharan Africa. But a country that has very good oil prospects. In fact, it's already been heavily exploited in the area off Port Gentile, and it has some real prospects of minerals exploitation as well. Republic of Congo, again, a country that's come out of nowhere for Australia. We established diplomatic relations on the same day as we did with Niger, 7th of May 2009. I presented credentials there in September of last year, which was quite a rare event for a non-resident ambassador to get such an early presentation of credentials. And there was a very good reason for that, and I'll come to that shortly, but it was to do with the Sundance plane disaster, where an entire board of the Sundance company got essentially lost their lives in an accident in a region which is right up there, which is a very remote part of Congo, and a very heavily forested part of Congo. The Gambia is completely surrounded by Senegal, as you can see. and probably one of the most difficult bilateral relationships that I could think of is between the Gambia and Senegal. There's historic reasons for that. The Brits had a claim to the river along here, and the French, of course, controlled in a colonial sense all the surrounding region. And the current president, who is the same age exactly as I, born in 1965, but he's been a president since 27 years of age, so almost for the same period of time I've been in DFAT. But he has been fermenting amongst the Kazamat people in the south here, a sort of a slow-burning rebellion of sorts. And every now and then he gets, this is President Jama, gets a nice little arms shipment from Iran, and we don't know what happens to that arms shipment, but there's a good guess that it might sort of seep down in some form or another to the Kazamunk people. And that's one of the causes for the difficult bilateral relationship. All right, so conscious I've got to keep moving, Nigeria. Nigeria, of course, does in many ways shadow all those countries I've just talked about and many more. It has, in some respects, a good record for its democratic credentials since 1999, and the last election that was held in April was seen very much as a credible process. Free and fair was used, but there were challenges. Registration, of course, was an enormous problem. There were post-election incidents that were of a very serious amplitude, upwards of 800 people potentially were killed, with various complex reasons for that occurring, but you know, in a general sense related to people being unhappy with a particular leader getting in and their opposition representative not getting in. A very interesting dynamic going on at the moment relates to a group calling themselves Boko Haram, which is seen as the Nigerian Taliban. The Boko Haram don't have a big, if you like, stronghold outside of their province of Borno. They are targeting government figures, government agencies such as the police, and they are causing a lot of unease amongst the government instrumentalities, and I think that at this stage the government really doesn't have a good strategy in terms of being able to address their concerns, neutralise them, and put in place some kind of, if you like, governing regime that will ensure that stakeholders by and large buy in to the Nigerian equation. What you have as a very important reality in Nigeria is a very impoverished north, and it's a very difficult challenge for the government, because in Nigeria the main economy, of course, is oil and gas, and that's in the near the Delta area. There's a wonderful book that I would recommend to you, which is A Swamp Full of Dollars by Michael Peel, and it gives a very interesting insight into a, if you like, extended period of exploitation of oil and gas reserves, but without giving enough back to the community that were directly affected. So what you have is this group called MEND, M-E-N-D, Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, and that's another significant security challenge. We had the 50th anniversary of Nigeria's independence on the 1st of October, and I was directed not to attend that Independence Day celebration for security reasons, and it was a good call because they let off a car bomb within around 800 metres of the Eagle Parade ground, and around about 6 to 8 people were killed, and obviously it scared the 15 heads of state that were present and many senior delegation leaders no end. And I guess it just underlines that there is a real weakness in terms of security control by the authorities and a capacity to minimise these risks. About 3 weeks ago, the Boko Haram allegedly set off a car bomb within 800 metres of our house, our residence in Abuja, and around 4 people killed and probably 55 cars totaled, completely destroyed. And it shook our house and it shook the region around the police headquarters. It was some serious hardware they were using. So what you have from these two incidents is a climate that you need to, without over-dramatising it, you need to be aware of the sorts of rather breathtaking, if you like, ambitions of some of these groups that want to make cause trouble and obviously press their own cause. But I think it's unfair to see that as the predominant, if you like, direction of Nigeria, which is very much a country that's looking to become a leader of the region. It's has aspirations to be a member of the UNSC as the United Nations Security Council, as a permanent member. And indeed in Africa, for instance, the Australian government position is to support 2 African permanent members. And it's an interesting issue about the way Nigeria can project itself. And I think many of you may have heard Permanent Secretary of the Nigerian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Martin Uhumoibi, who came and, I understand, gave a presentation here. Is that right, Graham?
Yes.
Yeah, around 2 months ago. And I think those that would have heard him will see a very different kind of Nigeria to the, if you like, the image of scammers and 419 rip-off merchants and people that you get unwelcome emails from on the internet. So I think Nigeria is projecting itself in the region as a mature, responsible power. It played a very constructive role in Cote d'Ivoire, and it's seen certainly by like-minded, the US and the UK, as a serious interlocutor that should be given respect and should be seen as a very potentially good ally for the interests that we are all pursuing. Very briefly on Benin, this is just going to be a cook's tour. We have mentioned about its reliance on smuggling, if you like, across the border. I've put in, there's many Beninois who come across to Nigeria, including our chef at the residence. He's a very good chef. The Benin chefs are seen as, they're mostly French trained, or they certainly have, let's say, the French influence in their cuisine. And it's a fascinating country. Of course, it struggles because it doesn't have a major sound economic underpinning. It has cotton, and cotton for small producers being muscled out by big agricultural economies is tough. Niger, I've talked very briefly before about the security issues there. There's a number of Australian companies, including Paladin Energy, which is a major uranium miner based in Perth, who are very interested in the resources in Niger. it's a country where it suffers, if you like, from the security challenges. And we've had, in January the 7th this year, two French nationals, one was an aid worker and another was his friend, were plucked from a restaurant in Niamey and taken by AKIM towards the border. It was probably going to be a ransom hostage issue. The French were already there because they've got five hostages still that they haven't been able to secure the release of in Mali. And they took pursuit, hot pursuit. The Niger troops took hot pursuit as well. There was a big firefight and it gets a bit messy and confusing after that, but hostages were both killed and about four Niger troops were killed and probably about four Al-Qaeda if you like, attackers were killed as well. But that's scaring off and giving cause for concern to investors. But some of you may have seen the Naomi Watts film, which focuses on Niger. And there's a famous line, which Bill, you seem to have got that line under. Do you remember the name?
What I didn't find in Niger.
What I didn't find in Niger. That's right. Which was tied in, of course, with the Iraq justification for moving in and replacing Saddam Hussein, because there was a suggestion that Niger was exporting nuclear fissile material, and that this was being given to the wrong people. And the name of that film,
Fair Game.
Cameroon, Gabon and Congo, I'm going to be very brief here. This is Central Africa, solid Central Africa. They're beautiful countries. Ecotourism could blast off any moment. The president of Gabon mentioned this to us. They've got pygmies in the forest. They've got the Congo River, the Congo Basin, one of the three main river systems of the world. This is a hotspot, an environmental hotspot. These countries know about that and they're trying to do the right thing. They're obviously looking for some support on that. On the Sundance tragedy, just very briefly, I did have a very close, awareness of that whole saga. I arrived in Yaoundé to accompany the Sundance delegation on the day the plane went down. And when I arrived at Yaoundé, the driver said, "We haven't had radio contact with the plane. It has the entire board." And these were all, of course, people that some of you may be aware of. Ken Talbot. There was Jeff Whitlock, Don Lewis. There were obviously people that were leaders in their field, principally a Perth community. And, of course, as the hours unfolded, it became apparent that they had serious problems, and they had a French Legionnaire security officer, and when they had made no contact, everyone knew that there was something seriously awry. And of course, in many ways, it was a miracle that the plane was found so quickly, because it's very deep, impenetrable jungle where the plane was located. And it was found after 3 days. There were about 10 or 12 air assets scouring the region. But it was found in Congo. So what then happened, the Congolese authorities said, "Hold on, it's our business now, we're going to look after it. We're going to repatriate the bodies back to Brazzaville." And they did a very fine job. They were very sensitive about it. They put a lot of resources into addressing it and to helping us with our challenge. There were some additional French, British and Americans on board, including six Australians. So it was a... This is when I referred to the baptism by fire. It has, in a very dramatic way, forged a bond with the Republic of Congo.
And it was one of the reasons, I think, that we were able to get my accreditation and the presentation of credentials. And I've been back, I've been there three times now, and it's a fascinating part of the world. We have Sundance proceeding with their investment. It's a major, it's probably one of the, certainly top 10 iron ore deposits globally. I think the Congolese authorities, the Cameroon authorities see it as very much a start of an exciting growth story for them. I'm going to have to come very quickly through the rest of these slides. Côte d'Ivoire, it's not in my patch, but in many ways it's a region, a country that has dominated the media. And I was with Bill Fisher and my colleague Billy Williams in Abidjan around 4-5 weeks ago, and it's a very interesting story. We came across a leadership who were extremely, extremely receptive to international acceptance and to partners that were interested in being constructive about engaging and indeed in being involved in the development of Côte d'Ivoire. And I think it could be a positive story for the future. Côte d'Ivoire's had enough tragedy and drama and trauma, and I do hope that it can pull itself through with President Ouattara and his new government. The Gambia, we've talked about the Gambia. I won't dwell on those points. We've already mentioned them. President Jammeh is a very all-powerful leader in the best sense of the or the worst sense of the African traditional strong leaders. He moves his ministerial colleagues around every year. So before anyone has a chance to be half credible, they are moved. He himself is a delightful character. He was very keen on the meeting I had with him to have an Australian kangaroo brought to Banjul, and I explained that it wasn't quite so easy to send a kangaroo all the way over there. Anyway, we'll have to work out a diplomatic way of explaining that. Finally, Australia's interests in West Africa. Enhanced political and economic engagement, including through visits of special envoys. We have our envoy for the Francophonie here. We also had our special envoy for Anglophone Africa, Bob McMullen, who many of you will be familiar with. He has been also working with missions in the region and undertaking visits. It's a great way of, without having the, if you like, the expenditure of a mission, it's a great way to be able to get high-level access. We've had calls on presidents in all the countries we've visited, and it's they like it. They see it as very much as a follow-up to our interest in presenting credentials, our mining companies that are active in the region. And it complements also the work that AusAid is doing with the modest increases in the aid budget. It's around $290 million, which has gone up from $190 million in the last budget, about $90 million increase. It's starting from a low base. This is not Asia for us, but it's there's money there now that we can do some interesting things, and it's compared to when I was High Commissioner in Mauritius, this is a very exciting time, actually, to be in Africa. And, in fact, it's a very exciting time to be in West Africa. There is a lot going on. We're doing a lot of travel. We're getting very good access. And it's you can see it complementing, amongst other things, the economic interest. And that key economic interest, of course, is in the mining, and we've been very involved in Africa Mining Down Under, which is coming up in a couple of weeks in Perth, and in Indaba, which is a big, if you like, assembly of mining companies and stakeholders in Cape Town in February. Just as a final slide, we have other, let's say, the major players in West Africa are not Australia, of course. The US is very, very big in Nigeria. It has, as an indication, around about 180 US personnel stationed in Nigeria. We have four. So they are just a quantum leap different in terms of their interests. 20% of its petroleum imports come from Africa, and most of that comes from Nigeria. China is a very interesting presence in Africa generally, but very much across West Africa, and I think we'll see a lot of growth in that story too. France, interestingly, is of course a historic big player on the scene, but it is it has very significant interest in Nigeria. And as you'll be aware with President Nicolas Sarkozy, there is an element of trying to break the rupture, if you like, from the past of seeing their, if you like, reflex response to any crisis in Africa is to, if you like, assist the Francophone government in place. I mean, they're now looking at it in a more hard-headed way, and that it's been an interesting process of how its relationship with Nigeria has evolved. But we haven't got time to go into any more of that. That really brings the slideshow to an end. So thank you very much. Michael, I'm apologetic that I'm over the time, but I'm very happy to be in your hands, and if anyone has any questions,
that's absolutely fine. Thank you very much. Well, you've heard the invitation to ask questions, and that's what, of course, it's all about. This is where we get to concentrate on that special piece of information we need to know for our own education. Who would like to ask the first question? Right here in front of me.
Marcus Wigan. I'm currently studying Islam politics. Nigeria is a large, part Muslim country of great interest. I wonder if you could comment on the compatibility of the democratic stance in the Muslim region, rather than the contrast between Christian and Islam.
So when you say contrast the democratic styles in within states within Nigeria, or
how actually is Islam being working with the government or against it or being it?
Look, it's a very interesting issue. Of course, a number of states in the north are implementing Sharia law, so you have a very real, if you like, incorporation and a buy-in to Islam into the management of those provinces. So these are the obviously the northern states. Sokoto springs to mind. I think the government, of course, needs to deal very sensitively with this issue, because you already we've got this extremist element, the Boko Haram, who are obviously they have the capacity to create a lot of mischief. And I think the government needs to, and this is the federal government as much as the state governments, need to play a very smart game to ensure that any, if you like, desire to strengthen, to incorporate Islamic principles into the, if you like, the machinery of government, have got the endorsement of the mainstream Islamic leadership. At this stage, I would say that, by and large, they've been able to do that. Most of those Islamic, if you like, majority states in the north are supportive of the federal government. This is a very interesting outcome of the election, that Good Luck Jonathan was able to get the endorsement of most of the northern governors. People say that that's a classic example of how the Nigerian elite system works, that you don't necessarily get too caught up on your ethnic group or your religion, but it's about what you can get from a negotiation, a financial negotiation. So this is why an election process can involve a significant drain on federal reserves or one's rather flexible and fungible oil account, because of course there is an element of needing to offer inducements. But at the end of the day, I think one's right to say that it's not a Christian versus Muslim situation in Nigeria, and there's a lot more complexity to the situation. There's the languages, there's the ethnic group dimension, there's the settlers, and the, if you like, the newly arrived. There's lots of border movements, there's droughts, a very complex, if you like, canvas that make up the dynamics of Nigeria.
Down the back.
Given the close proximity of the Ivory Coast, which I know is not the correct name, but it's the to Burkina Faso and Liberia, I just wondered whether you would have a sense of what the political situation is in those two countries, where there is Australian investment, but we were talking earlier on, there's been a little bit of news that filtered through about some instability in Burkina Faso. You don't hear anything though over in Australia. Our press is really terrible. So I'd be very interested to get a sense of what it's like there.
Look, to be frank, Burkina Faso, of course, is not in my patch, and Liberia, a similar situation. I couldn't give you an informed response to that. Of course, we have a general awareness of the challenges that all those countries are facing. They are very low down in the UN Development Index. They're all the statistics in relation to the sanitation and health and education levels, they're enormous challenges for all the governments. In some ways, you mentioned Australian miners are certainly active in both those countries, Burkina Faso particularly. It actually is a good story these mining projects can inject quite a lot of symbolic but also actual material gains for the communities and the governments. And it's, the Australian miners are the more I meet them and know them and see the work they do, they're great ambassadors by and large. Not everyone's perfect, but if you want to choose a mining operation globally, I reckon it's a very good brand, Australian Mining. And we have quite controlled legislation in relation to corruption and governance, and the Australian companies know they've got to comply. So, it's not like all the mining companies, but I can't really go much beyond that in terms of depth of knowledge of those countries.
Yeah. Our Vice President is showing extraordinary capacity to rise from his sickbed to be here tonight.
It'd be worth expanding on the role of China in Africa, because it's absolutely fascinating the way they're going about this. They're applying large amounts of money to governments without conditionality, apparently, at least in some cases. They're building special projects at the individual whims of particular governments. and bringing in their own workers in thousands, apparently, in some cases, to do this. So in this sense, they're competing directly with traditional Western, Western-oriented aid techniques, including the work of the World Bank, for example, the IMF, that do apply a lot of conditionality and worry about things like human rights.
Mm.
So it's a very interesting competition going on here.
Yes. Look, the sort of immediate answer I'd say is yes, and you know, these buildings all sort of fall down after 4 or 5 years, convention centres and parliaments and you know, various sort of public edifices that, you know, no one's really done a study on how useful they could be or how, you know, their maintenance could be ensured for the future. But I guess my an interesting observation that I came across in discussing this with a couple of mining companies is, and it was the French ambassador in Brazzaville, who again Bill and I have met. He said, "Oh, it's terrible. You know, the Chinese have moved in. They're taking business away from our French companies, and it's a threat. And they're you know, good for nothings. They're not really you know, contributing to the economy." And this mining executive said, "That's not how we look at it from an Australian perspective. We're working. China's too big to, if you like, ignore or to indeed dismiss in that way. What we want to do is work with them." And I think you'll see it's already, you know, in very public ways. You'll see Australian companies are keeping control of projects, but they're getting a lot of Chinese finance in. And it's a win-win for the Chinese companies. It's a win-win for the Australian companies who get the finance. They still are able to dictate the terms of the project. And the governments like it too. And I know of some very big Australian mining interests that are looking at that way in terms of the China story. But you're right, these buildings are all over the place. And it's not, I mean, I've seen it in Comores, Madagascar, and some, superficially, everyone loves these projects. No conditionality. You get something solid for your money. You know, there's a big building there. It stands out. It's on a hill. It gets a great location. But it is a bit superficial. And I, you know, in terms of aid direction, I think you know there's a lot of dangers in moving down that way, that path. And I think obviously, you know, us and like-mindeds have a different emphasis on governance, on addressing health and education and sanitation, you know, those sorts of nuts and bolts sectors. But the China formula is has its own attractions.
It always comes up with Nigeria, is where's the money gone? They've been exporting oil since 1955. I don't know how many hundreds of millions or billions of dollars have flowed in for oil growth. But still we read of the chaos, the filth and corruption, all those. Where one would have thought, applying our Western standards, all this money would have been applied to resolving all the social problems. But so, where's the money gone? Maybe you can't answer that. And the next guy's fast one, but the group, the Bokhara group, or how
Boko
you
Haram, it? Yeah. Boko Haram.
Boko Haram. What do they stand for?
On the first question, the economics of Nigeria, it's a very interesting issue. There's very little tax paid. So people would feel badly done by if they had to pay tax. So in other words, you've got a very heavy reliance on oil to run the country. You know, in a way we just wouldn't understand or relate to in Australia. So there is a lot of expenditure that ineffectually takes place, maybe, but it comes straight from oil. They haven't got the luxury of drawing on significant tax income. So there's, in a way, that's just to say, instead of the Australian government having, you know, oil income, resources income, and tax in Nigeria, it's just oil. The other aspect of the way the country is established, it's a federal system. It's a very expensive system to run, because it started off. Have we got any Nigerians here? Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. All right. We've got a couple of experts here, but it started off essentially with a kind of three-state matrix. And then it's gradually moved up to 36 now, so it's 35 plus the federal capital territory. Each time a state or a bunch of states is created, you have a governor, you have a legislature body to engage, you have cars, you have a whole range of expenditures. It is true, and it's recognised within Nigeria, that the average senator gets paid more than Barack Obama. And that's an official salary. This is not what other entitlements they might have here. So there is an element of perhaps a different perception of what we would find acceptable here, that some of these office public office holders, who indeed, as we know in Australia, the sensitivity about it is that it's the legislators that set their own salary. So that's why they have to have a low salary. That's what we, of course, impose as a discipline. But it's, of course, there is there's the challenge of corruption and governance. But in a way, it's a system that works, and it gets back to a point that I raised at the outset. It's not a perfect system, but all the key stakeholders are on board across the incredible, diversity of and complexity of the interests that need to be satisfied, need to be brought on board. And, our former Prime Minister said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, on a couple of occasions. It's not a justification, but it's just trying to have some explanation of why you don't see more bang for your buck than you do.
Bob Foss has been trying desperately to ask a question.
I have. Our Elvis was born in Nigeria in 1957, and that's not the basis of what I'm going to talk about and ask about. But I worked in the Niger Delta in the high swamp forest, and we found oil at Aloy Bridge, and ultimately a bit more oil, and a pipeline was built to Port Harcourt. I worked for Shell, and we announced to the government the good news that we thought we ought to build a refinery in Port Harcourt and enable Nigeria to have a domestic supply of petroleum fuel, gasoline and whatnot. The government said, no, you can't build a refinery, all the oil must be exported and we will import our petroleum products. Mm. Now, I assume that's changed and that there are now refineries. Are there now refineries? Are there now lots of refineries? And when did they change their policy?
Well, I think you raise that assumption with some knowledge that it hasn't actually changed in reality on the ground. It's an amazing sort of, failing really of the system that they have such significant oil reserves. They export their oil, but their actual refinery capacity is very limited. They've got a couple of refineries, but they're a very small part of their overall their market. There's obviously I think the current government is aware of the importance of this issue. They have to cap off the problem that they have. They have a very generous fuel subsidy, and this fuel subsidy is not on their crude; it's on their refined oil. So they're getting the average litre in US, let's say Aussie cents, it's about 45 cents, 50 cents to a litre, a I mean, that's a third of what we're paying, or, you know, almost a third. So it's an expensive subsidy that they're covering the costs of. And fuel is a big issue. Power is another incredible challenge for Nigeria, because we think of Hazelwood. Is it Hazelwood? Which produces 2,000 megawatts. Well, Nigeria's absolute maximum capacity off its main grid is 2,800, 2,750 megawatts. It's a bit more than Hazelwood. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of other ways that they supplement the supply of electricity generators. It's the biggest importer of generators. For those of you that might have seen the article in The Economist recently. And there's obviously vested interest too that would need to be addressed in terms of resolving that issue. But in terms of petroleum products and in terms of electricity generation, these are very big issues the government is trying to address. And I think Goodluck Jonathan has a fairly savvy awareness of it. Now, the challenge is to do something about it. And I think that'll be interesting to see what he does over the next few years.
Thank you. Yes, in a minute.
I was going to ask about the future for the region. You made a comparison between geologically between Brazil and the region. I mean, is there any chance Nigeria are embarking on a Brazil-like growth pattern, or at least for people to start to rise out of poverty in the region, or do you see there being ongoing turmoil and more growth?
Well, the growth is comparatively high for Nigeria, obviously driven by population growth, which is in excess of 3%. So you do have a growth story, and it's a growth story that is underpinned by some pretty secure fundamentals. So you get companies like Macquarie are putting money into some of the infrastructure projects there. So smart money is there. Telecommunications is phenomenal. You know, the mobile phone market is one of the most prospective globally. They don't have landlines that work, but mobiles are, it's just phenomenal what money's been made there. They've got very good digital access coming in from cabling down the west coast of Africa, and Nigeria is really starting to get very e-savvy in terms of the way it does business. So it's a hard one, because you know I could say, oh, it's a great market, it's lots of money to be made, you just need to sort of be patient. I think it's a stretch, of course, to say it could ever start looking like Brazil. It's got the mineral, geology of the surrounding countries. It could develop a minerals industry. That's definitely on the cards. There's some issues about, internal security issues that scare investors off. And that is seen very much by the current government as a key challenge, especially the North. And they're trying to do something about it. The government is addressing it can be a tinderbox. The British Council did a very interesting study on population growth and the dangers of, and the potentiality of Nigeria harnessing its youth. It could either go that way or it could either go that way. It's very interesting, and people, it made quite a few waves. The youth of Nigeria are very passionate, very articulate. A lot of them are very well educated. Enormous numbers study in the US and the UK. It's actually, we we have a very unbalanced picture of how Nigeria functions in Australia, and it's difficult. It's got lots of challenges. It's not a you need to do your homework. But as a power player, they do talk of Nigeria overtaking South Africa in terms of the size of the economy in the next 5 to 8 years. So you've got the economic, if you like, foci or loci of Africa is moving towards Nigeria. So it's an interesting space to watch. Not Brazil yet, but, you know, in time.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Ian. I'm just watching the time, and unfortunately we'll have to stop because I know that you've got a dinner engagement tonight, and I know that the representative of DFAT in Victoria has a dinner engagement tonight as well. The two may be coincidental.
That could be the case.
I just want to thank you very much indeed for your presentation here tonight, as we all do. I'm fascinated. I've learnt about a new group that I can probably remember the name of. Boko Haram. Sounds so much nicer than Al-Qaeda. Probably a little bit more interesting. But overall, your run-through of the countries that you're representing Australia in was, I thought, particularly fascinating and very instructive. Most of us, I guess, over the years have had contact with Nigeria through letters we've received about deposits in banks over there, which readily made available if you supply some money for
That's
them.
Right, yeah.
You no doubt do a lot of work with Australians looking for their money that they've given. But all in all, we've improved our knowledge immeasurably of the situation in Western Africa, and therefore we thank you very much indeed. And would you join with me in thanking? And for your trouble, you get a special presentation.
Oh, excellent.
Learn all about the Australian Institute of International Affairs.
Can I just say one thing? I have a few newsletters that we, if people are kind of interested in what we do as a mission, there won't be enough to go around, but they are. There's a few here that you could even have a look at. And we can put you on a sort of, if you like, a distribution, electronic distribution list, if you want. So that's the publication. And indeed, there is even a picture of Mr. Bill Fisher talking with Ali Bongo.
Well, there you are.
So this is a collector's edition. It's been worth a lot of money sometimes.
You can't ask for a lot more than that.
So I'll leave them.
Thank you
here.
Very much indeed. Now, I'll just mention a couple of things. On Thursday, the 28th of July, Australia's Search for Security, Cameron Stewart, the associate editor of The Australian, a Murdoch Press man, is going to be coming here, so you can ask him all the questions that the Select Committee in UK didn't do to his bosses the other night. He's on next Thursday, or the Thursday, the 28th. I'd also like to mention the Quarterly Access publication. Now, you mentioned the youth. We are very, very impressed with the work of our Access group, which is the youth of the AIIAV, and they produce documents all over the place. This is the most recent one. I don't know whether you'd like to have a look at the sort of stuff that they're producing. It gives people the opportunity, particularly students, the opportunity of being published at times and in places where they wouldn't otherwise get the chance. So they hold some magnificent functions. They had one down at the Edge this week with about 200 or 300 people attending, and so there we are for that.
All right.
And ladies and gentlemen, we do need to know a lot more about this area of the world, and we've had a very interesting introduction to it tonight. So thank you for your attendance. I declare the meeting closed, and have a very happy dinner.
Thank you very much, Michael. Okay.